Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and welcome to this Memorial Day Monday. Memorial Day is a very solemn day of remembrance for everyone who has died serving in the American Armed Forces. The holiday actually started off as Decoration Day, and that started after the Civil War to honor the Union and Confederate who had died. And I always like thinking about the military and the armed services because in total, the active number is approximately 1,429,000 serving, which is, if you think about it, if you do the math, that is one-half of 1% of the population of the United States serving and defending our population of roughly 330 million. So I would think in that job is pretty stressful, and we need to always be praying and supporting our men and women who are serving in the armed forces. And, of course, today we are remembering and reflecting on those who have died in service on the battlefield, serving our country. The late Senator Paul Tsongas from Massachusetts said, "America is hope. It's compassion. It is excellence. It is valor." I just thought that's always a great quote. And Ronald Reagan said, "Freedom is not ours by inheritance. It must be fought for and defended constantly by each generation. For it comes only once to people. Those who have known freedom and then lost it have never known it again." So we've got a really great show today. We've got a number of powerful testimonies of people who have experienced loss through service to our military. And we're going to actually start our conversation this morning with a very cool Navy SEAL. Excuse me. Rourke Denver was in the movie Act of Valor, playing himself. How cool is that? You get to go be in a movie, get to be yourself. That's my goal one day. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to enjoy a conversation that I actually had this conversation with Rourke about a year ago, but it's so good. I thought, let's pull this out. Let's boot this up. Let's play it again on this Memorial Day. So we'll take a short break and be back with Rourke Denver. Welcome back on this Memorial Day, and if you're spending your Memorial Day wisely, maybe you're sleeping right now. Maybe that's what you need more than anything, is a little extra shut-eye so you're not even hearing me say this. So maybe you'll just be tuning in later, but this is an interview I didn't want anyone to miss because I had the pleasure of talking to Rourke Denver a while ago, and he was such a cool guy, Navy SEAL, tough guy, kind of like me. So we had a lot in common. I thought, well, let's talk to him again. Let's bring a segment of that interview back into the show. He's an author, he's an actor, and he's a former U.S. Navy SEAL. He's written a book called Worth Dying For. I found him fascinating. Let's hear a part of that story and that interview I had last year. Rourke is a Navy SEAL commander. He's star of the hit film Act of Valor. Denver was awarded the Bronze Star with V for Valorous Action in Combat. And happy Memorial Day, Rourke. Glad to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. Happy Memorial Day as well. Appreciate it.
It is nice to meet and interview the man I am most often mistaken for.
Well, no question about it. I get the same with you. So, yeah, it's good to finally link up.
Most everyone I've ever spoken to have Navy SEALs as this very mysterious, ultra cool, only the coolest guys in the world ever get to do this. And so, you know, talk about that a little bit.
It is a very unique brotherhood. I was a competitive athlete my entire life and still love to compete in sports and played up through college and just have always been probably right on the fringe of unhealthily competitive. You know, just it's kind of my background, I think, just in my DNA. But I didn't really find the brotherhood of the peer group that I really, really wanted to be connected to until I made it into the SEAL teams. And it is a very special group. It's, the culling process there on Coronado Island that, 75 to 80% of young lions that show up don't see the finish line. And that leaves a very, very special group, 20, 25% that end up there, and just very like-minded, intense, focused, driven, passionate people that want to go serve their country and do it at the far extreme of any operation that you can be asked to go do in the military. So I feel very, very lucky to have been a part of it and humbled to have done it.
How much of it is physical prowess and how much of it is a pure head game?
I'd say easily 90-10 head game to physical.
Wow.
Now, I say that,
yeah.
But everybody shows up fit. So, I mean, look, if you took a cross-section of America and just threw people in, the physical would become very much a leading part of the capacity to finish the program. But so everybody's fit going in. That's a baseline. Since that's the case, we know that. So it does come down to your mind and I think your spirit, what you bring to that fight, that kind of alchemy of traits and behaviors that, you know, hopefully your parents and mentors and pastors and coaches gave you growing up. And if you have that, we can't stop you as an instructor corps. And if you don't, you're probably going to run into a wall that you're not going to get past.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you make it through SEAL training and become a SEAL, I know you're supposed to have this humility to you, but you kind of deep down know you're the baddest guy in the block, right?
I think you have a certain confidence that certainly arises from it and that grows out of it that yes, it probably puts you in a different mindset than most of the people walking down the street. But I also think that humility is, you said it, is equally as important. And, you know, I remember when I was going to Iraq in 2006, one of my later combat deployments, my father's partner at the time was a former Army officer in Vietnam, had achieved unbelievable distinguished awards. I think several silver stars, bronze stars for, just unbelievable action and combat. And remember, my dad said, hey, he's going over there with the best trained, the most capable guys. And his buddy Len turned and said, don't make them bulletproof.
Yeah.
And he was right. You know, so it really is one of those things where you can be pretty confident, but it doesn't mean you're indestructible.
Talk a little bit about the training that is involved when you are obviously being trained to go kill people.
I wrote an entire chapter in Worth Dying For about killing,
which
it kind
I thought
of happened
was...
organically. It wasn't something I set out to write, and it just became one of my favorite chapters.
It's one of my favorite chapters, too.
Thank you.
Yeah,
no,
I really
enjoyed writing about it.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a very different, you know, read on people talking about that subject. And it's not so much, hey, here's numbers of kills. It really is what it means and what I think it should mean. And so there's two answers to the question. The first answer is you can train mechanically almost anything. And I don't say that to be, you know, shallow in the description, but you can just through repetition and practice and making very realistic training scenarios, you can train, you know, the human mind and kind of body to do almost anything, to fight past natural instincts and so on. So we do that. We train through repetition and some of the, you know, kind of back channel psychological ways to get somebody prepared to respond to a threat and to do that in a consistent, uniform, mechanical way. The other, I think, much more important part is the kind of spiritual or you know, emotional connection to you know, taking someone else's life. And I think that's, you'd probably be surprised at how little we train to it. At the same time, we just have a group of guys that get through the program. The program is just beautifully designed to do this, that have an emotional maturity and a desire to go get in harm's way and to face our nation's enemies. And I think every guy kind of metabolizes it the same. And we're seeing that across the military. There's folks that, you know, have been involved in deadly force events that have taken a tremendous psychological toll and are fighting with PTSD and trauma from it. And there's a bunch of people that have done the exact same thing and come out of it very, very healthy. And I feel very much on that side of the line and very lucky that that's the case. And so so there's two parts of it, the mechanical and the mental.
Mm-hmm. When you are involved in operations, I don't know how much of this you can share, but what percentage of planned operations started to go south and you had to go to plan B?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You could probably say all of them. I mean, in some way, you know, one of the famous lines of kind of, you know, military planning is that no plan survives first contact. No plan you ever built once bullets start flying or bombs go off is gonna hold up, you know, as you expected it. I would only say maybe 25 out of the, you know, hundreds of missions I've led over in, you know, Iraq and other hotspots in the world, I'd say maybe only 25% of them did I say, wow, this is a major departure from what we thought was going to happen. Now, there were always little nuances, but the team was just so well trained that very few of those bumps in the road were not instantly dealt with and didn't even become an issue. But, you know, 20-25%, you'd kind of say, wow, we need a big change and we need to change right now.
You completely rely on your training, and that's really a wonderful principle. as you go out into the world in whatever you do, to have a plan and to have training that you can rely on, because there had to have been so many times when you were in combat where if it wasn't for the training kicking in, you would have been in trouble.
Yeah, another one of the great lines, you don't rise to the moment, you reduce to your training, or you degrade to your training. People don't like kind of meet the moment, you know, and just have this glorious day. You usually fall back to exactly what you've practiced. And that's why, you know, even with my kiddos, when they're practicing something, I really focus on practice right, because this is how you'll play. So you can't do the other. You can't practice poorly and then perform well. There's not a coach on earth that would not validate that point. So training is one of my favorite things to talk about. When I talk to corporate America or teams, and I talk about that, I love focusing on training, because it is the thing that we control utterly. Talent, your ability,
right,
what the enemy's going to do or what your opponent's going to do, you have very, very little influence over that. But what you've done in advance of that fight, that is all on your dime. And so if you train hard and you sweat in peace, then, you know, it keeps you from bleeding in war.
Yeah. Well, I went and saw the film Act of Valor that you were in. Talk about that experience a little bit.
It was very interesting, and I don't think you'll see it again in many ways. You know, all the military folks in that movie were all active duty military, whether it was a boat driver, pilot, SEAL in the movie, and we were on orders. I mean, we had a set of Navy written orders, just like you get orders to go to communication school or sniper school or any other set of tasks that the Navy would assign you to do to go make that film. The thing that was enjoyable about it was the two directors who came from Hollywood, you know, no military background. They just were very much interested in getting the story right, authentic, and not Hollywoodizing it up, you know, not trying to make it different or other than it was, which every movie, even the true to life one, ends up doing. They honored us, I think, in allowing us to do that. We were very cognizant while making it not to give a playbook to our enemy, so we changed tactics and weapons and things like that, because we didn't want to give the bad guys the actual playbook. But we tried to make it very, very authentic. And, you know, I think people thought that movie was going to go straight to DVD and you'd pick it up at Walmart, and it became the number one movie in America. So it was pretty unbelievable.
Rourke, talk a little bit about bravery. And I don't know if you're born brave, but the bravery that you have to go into places and to do things. Were you born with that, or did they develop that in you?
It's one of my favorite subjects, the idea of bravery and courage and how that builds. I think it is something that is innate. And I have a great quote in my book from a, you know, Civil War veteran saying that it was, you know, it basically lives latent in every soul, that it exists. You know, bravery's there. There just needs to be opportunity or moments that bring it out. Now, that said, while I think it does kind of exist within all of us on some level, I think it can be trained to. And I think it is something that you can, you know, somewhat immerse or inoculate yourself to it. As I was saying with the killing, we put our lions through, you know, our warriors and SEALs that are getting prepared for the battlefield through unbelievably realistic, demanding, even beyond possible type training scenarios. So you've seen it before, you felt it before. And I can say wholeheartedly, the very first time someone popped up with an AK-47 and started shooting at me, it did not feel like the first time. I mean, it was a I knew it, I'd practiced it, I'd seen it before, I'd thought about it. And so I was able to respond very effectively because of that. And that's one of the real beauties of our level of intense training, is it does prepare you for those moments.
Yeah. Well, we're talking to Rourke Denver, and he's written a book called Worth Dying For. We're going to take a little break. Happy Memorial Day. We'll be right back. Welcome back. So glad you're joining us today on this Memorial Day. Let's get back to our conversation with Rourke Denver. I feel like a golf analyst here. Let's return to the interview with Rourke Denver, already in progress. We're talking about combat and war, and I want to shift a little bit into your faith and what it's like on the battlefield with men and women putting their life at risk all the time, and what they think about in their spiritual life in everyday combat.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to each individual, of course.
Each
man on the field. And I think it's a very interesting thing. I mean, I think this country was founded on faith-based ethic that I think has taken us very, very far. I think we've gotten pretty far away from that. And I think we're now, you know, enjoying is not the right word, but artistically, you know, the fallout from that. I grew up in the church. I grew up in the Episcopal Church as a kid and was an altar boy and all that good stuff. And I think like many young men and probably women, when I went to college, I drifted away from it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a priority in my life. The battlefield didn't bring it back, to be honest. And I like being honest about this because it's been a very interesting kind of experience. I went through, I think, a big part of my military career also not leaning very, very heavily on faith and kind of having a connection to that. And I think when I had children and my bride kind of very similar experience growing up with me in her kind of path, both felt a calling back to that would be important in our lives and important for our kids and a lot of what we see in the world. It sure seems like getting away from some of the principles and beliefs and behaviors that you learn in the church and learn by following that path are lacking greatly in our culture. And so we've reconnected to it. This is even recently. So it's been a great thing in our lives and something that we won't let slip again.
Yeah.
I had both type people on the battlefield with me. I had buddies that I knew were of tremendous, tremendous religious faith and had mm-hmm. that very much on their sleeve and something that people knew. And I had guys that were absolutely the opposite and wanted nothing to do with it. And they all coexisted in a pretty special way, which mm-hmm. I think is a testament to the brotherhood and that everybody lets each operator, you know, kind of believe what they believe, but also performance is what counts, you know, the most out there. But I think those that had faith have an advantage. I don't think there's any doubt in my mind about that. I mean, one of my best friends that was actually an act of valor with me is a man of tremendous faith and always has been. I just, you know, he had a pillar of strength that I think other people didn't have. And so I think it's a gift you give yourself in many ways, of course. But on the battlefield, I don't think you're doing yourself a disservice having that as a foundation.
Let's talk a little bit about, obviously, you feel blessed to be an American, as do I. So thank you for your service, of course. But as Americans, we owe something in return, all of us do, don't we?
I sure think so. And I mean, I don't say that to serve myself, having been a veteran. I mean, the thing that's interesting about Memorial Day is very much focused on, particularly to the warrior, those that didn't come home. You know, Veterans Day in
right.
my mind, the day that we honor all those that serve. Memorial Day is very, very focused, at least for us, on those that didn't come back, which we hold in the highest regard and the highest esteem. But I do think it does focus people on military and those who have served and so on. So I think it's very interesting being a veteran and being out in the world and trying to help guide other veterans into their post-military life. I mean, I think you find just a tremendous source of belonging and motivation and pride being part of the military. And a lot of guys and gals, when they get out, find that lacking and really struggle and wrestle with what they're going to go do. And there's also this idea of hero and heroism, which I write about in Worth Dying For, and that I think people believe everyone in the military is a hero. I'm not going to begrudge anybody for saying that. I think almost everyone, I'm sure you've interviewed people besides me that just don't feel that way. I mean, they just feel like they were doing a job, giving their best. They were put in pretty exceptional situation and came out of it. But, you know, I've got a good teammate that has earned some of the highest awards you can earn multiple times over. He is no doubt a hero and now feels tremendous pressure to live up to that hero standard. You know, feels just tremendous weight on his back. You know, now he's out of the military. He just wants to, you know, put food on the table for his kiddos and he, you know, trying to get a job and make that work. And he feels tremendous pressure to kind of live up to this hero standard. So I think one thing we can do as a civilian populace is actually just give heroes some space and give them some grace to know that might have been one exceptional moment. Their everyday life, they're dealing with all the same stuff of you and me.
Mm-hmm. What do people in the military, what do they like when civilians want to show appreciation? What is the best thing for us civilians to say or do?
It's a great question, and I think it doesn't have one answer. I mean, I think
okay.
I think anyone that goes thanks somebody for their service, you're doing the right thing. You know, you see a young soldier in uniform walking through, an airport, looks like he needs a note from mom to be wearing that uniform. Go thank that young Marine or airman for their service, no doubt.
Yeah.
I think folks that you might know in your life that served, just stay connected to them. I mean, I think one of the things we're seeing with folks that are having problems from their time on the battlefield is they'll kind of disconnect and pull themselves out of your kind of the day-to-day stuff. And if you know someone that served, has come back, of course, on some level, they're going to be different. But if you feel like they're withdrawing and pulling back, go engage. Go fishing. Go get a cup of coffee. Go spend time. You got to be careful. We're all not mental health professionals.
Right.
But I think you just got to re-engage and kind of help bring them back into the fold, but just back into normal life.
Mm-hmm. And with your training and experience, what is it like just walking around town?
I make a distinction in my life when I talk about this. I've written about this a little bit, but I make a little bit of a distinction between a soldier and a warrior. I see those as separate and distinct a little bit. And what I mean is, a soldier might be somebody that maybe they enlisted to pay for college. Now they're going to go do a job in the military. They might not necessarily be, on the front lines in harm's way. They're going to move on. I absolutely honor anyone who gives that service. It's a real thing. Above that or in a different place is a warrior, and warriors are who gravitate towards the SEAL teams and special operations. They have just had this, this blood in their veins that wants to fight, wants to see justice like offered, wants to be, out in the mix and not just resting on letting other people guide the way things unfold. And I feel very much in that camp. So as I walk around town, I'm not always at war. I feel like in an unhealthy way,
mm-hmm.
but I'm prepared for the fight. I'm prepared to, I think, or make something right if I see it being wrong, to say something and speak out if I see something that I don't think is as it should be. And I think we're actually hurting right now as a culture and a society not doing it. I think people are happy to watch bad things unfold, and it is a very, very dangerous thing. If good people aren't stepping in to do the right thing, we're just going to fall apart. So I'm just kind of aware and stay focused on, where can I hopefully make an impact?
Well, I know our country is in need of heroes, and I think it's amazing as I look at the effort and the devotion and dedication the Navy SEALs have. They're clearly all heroes in my opinion. And as I was looking over some of the few remaining pages of your book, you say, live boldly, act decisively, stand for something real. The people who built our country did that. We must too. Jump in and behave according to the highest standards you have set for yourself. That is what the spirit of America teaches us. That's awesome.
Whew, sounds good. I'm excited to have written that.
Isn't that kind of cool when you think about it?
And it's cool. It's cool. I feel like it is unacceptable to just accept your station in life. And I am utterly sensitive and believe that, if you're born into my house with my dad and mom, who are mm-hmm. both intelligent, focused, driven people that then teach their kids to be that, I have a better chance, no doubt in my mind, than someone that's born in, the tough streets of Chicago or Houston or some spot with absolutely no guidance. That
mm-hmm.
said, I still believe we enjoy a unique position in the world that you can elevate your status through hard work, effort, diligence, and just a little bit of grit. And if you can do that, you will. And so I write that saying, don't just rest on, this is where I am, this is where I'll always be. I don't believe that, and you should ask more of yourself.
Yeah. Rourke, this has been really interesting, and we only have 1 minute left, so I'm just going to throw this out. Another little tried and takeaway is don't let anyone narrow your dreams.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was blessed to have the parents I had. My dad is very regimented and disciplined and focused, and my mom is an absolute artistic, dreaming kind of wingnut, and I mean that in a great way. I got both. So
I take it in a good way.
Kind of set to the task and mm-hmm. focus, but I also believe anything is possible. And if you believe that, it is. It is.
Well, I so appreciate it. Thanks for being an amazingly wonderful guest on such a historic day. Your book, again, is Worth Dying For, A Navy SEAL's Call to a Nation by Rourke Denver, New York Times bestselling author. Thanks for being on the show, Rourke, and happy Memorial Day.
Likewise. Happy Memorial Day to you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. That was nice to be able to enjoy that interview with Rourke Denver. It's funny. It was exactly a year ago on Memorial Day we spoke to him, almost like we did it deja vu. We're going to take a short news break. And when we come back, I'm going to have a chance to talk to a 100-year-old World War II vet. Stay tuned for that. Welcome back on this Memorial Day. Boy, what happens when you get drafted into the war and you can sing, dance, and play trumpet? Huh, they might have different plans for you. My guest on the studio line is Al Jarrus. He is from the Connecticut area, and he is 100 years old, a World War II veteran. You were in World War II, and you played in the band?
Yes, yes. I really was lucky. I didn't see any service. Yes, I played music most of the time. I played just music. When I was drafted, they put me in a band, and of course, anyway, that's the story.
Well, I want to get the story started, and Al, I want to hear a little bit about you were born in 1917, is that correct?
Yes.
So if I do the math, let's see, carry the one, let's see, that would make you roughly 100 years old, is that right?
That is right. For 2 weeks now, I've been 100 years
old. So you've been 100 years old for 2 weeks, so my congratulations on a beautiful life that you've lived, and I'm very interested to hear about your experience in World War II and how that all started. And I know that you ended up playing as part of the band, and yet you were over and having all kinds of experiences. Where did you start? Where did you travel to when you started your time in the service?
Well, it was Bangor, Maine is where I started. The Air Force, they had a base, that's where I started it all, in Maine.
Did you get an
opportunity? I was drafted, and they put me in the band right away. Never expected to be there.
Yeah. Now, Al, what instrument did you play?
I played trumpet.
Okay.
The trumpet and I sang.
Okay.
And we put shows on the radio and everything for the people, and also played for the officers. Anyway, we entertained an awful lot in many different ways, yeah.
And Al, was the reception for the entertainment, I bet it was very well received, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They loved to. Yeah. Oh, yes.
It was an important part of the war, and to have the spirits lifted and to have times when you could put the idea of the war aside and just be entertained.
Definitely. Oh, definitely. I didn't think about it much at the time, but after I said, you know, it is important, you know, make the guys feel good, forget everything else, yeah.
And now, how much time would you spend in rehearsal?
Well, it was more or less daily.
Okay.
Daily routine, you know, you'd practice yourselves, and daily have practice with the band and the orchestra, because we had a concert band we went and did concerts with, you know. Then within the band, we had a couple of jazz bands for entertainment, for dancing, you know. And as I say, in the main, we even put on radio shows. I remember skits, you know, and whatever we could do.
Okay. Now, did you do some comedy skits yourself on the radio?
Yes.
And then what was some of your favorite music? I know the Andrews Sisters were a big hit during the war. Did you have any particular favorites yourself?
Well, I liked Bing Crosby an awful lot. And, of course, Glenn Miller as a band. Bing Crosby is a singer, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever?
They were about the best. There were so many that were very, very good.
Yeah. Now, Al, did you ever sing any Bing Crosby songs yourself? And could you sing a little bit for us now?
Songs? Oh yeah, I did White Christmas an awful lot, especially around Christmas time.
Yeah. Can you give us a bar of White Christmas?
Oh, yeah. Well, my voice is not that good this morning. But anyways, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, you know?
Beautiful. Love you it.
Like the ones I used to know.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that and then so many other songs. One other one at the time was kind of popular was Wait For Me, Mary. You know, until the world smiles again.
Yeah, and there were a lot of loss. And did you have personal friends that you lost during the war? I'm sure you lost quite a few, didn't you?
Yeah, yes, a lot. Yeah, a lot of friends because we. I was about a year at Maine, and then we transferred to Langley Field, where they had a really big dance band. And there we entertained the Flyers every noon, every day. They'd be passing through where they'd come have their lunch, and they'd watch our show, you know.
Wow.
And that was a real big big thing, real big band, yeah. That's where the Battle of the Bulge was taking place, and they lost a lot of men. So they took us out of the band and put us in the infantry. So we wound up carrying rifles and getting our basic training and getting ready to go over to Germany, you know, as infantrymen, not bandsmen. And then the war was over in Europe. So they shipped us over to the Philippines to finish it off there, you know. And when I got there, didn't get to fight, but they were waiting for people to take their places in the bands that were there, you know. And I lucked out again. They took me and put me in a band. And that's where I wound up when I'm my own. They made me the leader of the concert band and the orchestra.
Wow.
Singers and whatever entertainment we had, yeah. And then we wound up in Japan when the war was over, and we were, I think, the first ones to go into Japan, yeah. So
you had a rifle under one arm and your trumpet under the other, and they train you and you ship overseas. But then you still continue to get to do your music, don't you?
Yeah, luckily, yes, luckily, because I went over with, I think I was in charge of a platoon, and I forget that because I was a sergeant then. But anyway, instead of going over and fighting and finishing up the war in the Philippines, I got to get in the band again. Wow.
You always end up back in the band, Al. That's what I love about this story. It's you continue to do.
Well, yeah, before I went into service, I had my own band too in Waterbury, and then after the service, I had my own band in Actors Colony in Derby. I played there for 13 years after the war.
Just a delight. All right, more with Al coming up next. Be back in a minute. Song. So glad you're with us today. Talking to Al Jarrus from the Connecticut area. And Al is 100 years old. And he sings, he dances, he plays trumpet. I love trumpet music, Al. So do you still bring the trumpet up to your lips now and then? Or is
Yes. I had a stroke a year ago, and I'm just kind of getting back to it. I let it go for quite a while, and it's just not working right.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I kind of pick it up and blow a few notes into it.
You're back to playing it. You're back to working on it a little bit.
That's what I'm trying to do, is really get back to where I play with a lot of bands in Waterbury and the surroundings, yeah. I don't know if you remember Victor Zambreski, an old polka band.
I don't know that name.
He was around for years and years, started in, I think, in the 30s. Anyway, I didn't even pay him to play with him.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So many Andy Nichols, the champ, Ted Grahosky, and Bigfoot, champion. So,
well, yeah. I'm interested about when the airmen would come through for lunch and then they would get a show. I found it interesting that the Army and the military would want entertainment to be part of their stop, that they would want to refresh the troops. And that was an important part of their visit, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So, Al, what...
Red Skelton was passing by, and the band accompanied him on his show, you know.
Oh, nice. Did you get a chance to meet him?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, yeah. And I was on the show. I sang a song, and he introduced me, you know. My name is really a long name. It's Yoda Savages, not Jarvis. I cut it in half. But that's what it was in the Army, you know, Fons Jarvis Savages, you know. Anyway, when he got to me, he said, here, and here is to sing a song, whatever it is, a sergeant, and he stopped, you know, when my name, because he didn't try to pronounce it. It was so long and a little hard. He used to murder it, and even the sergeants would call me. But anyway, he stopped, and he said, and here comes the soldier, and he says, no wonder they hand out serial numbers in the Army, you know. So instead of my name, he made that comment, and I never did announce my name.
Yeah. So, Al...
Danny Kaye and Leo DeRocher, I was with them traveling when they were putting a show on. And then a couple of others that I work with and played the band for, a comedian, TV. So I work with a few name guys, back them up, you know, with the band when they did the music.
Did you ever work with Bob Hope?
No, I never did. No. There was that, gosh. He was very nice. He had his own TV program, and he introduced Carol Burnett on his program. And I forget now his name. He was very nice. In the Philippines, we put on quite a few shows and traveled with him, you know, throughout the Philippines.
Yeah. And Al, what do you think about today's music?
It's very hard for me to... I don't listen to it because it's so loud. So loud. Even the people who we had somebody here, Don Most.
Mm-hmm. He was Ralph Melf from Happy Days.
They're very good, but it was not enjoyable. It was so loud. Even his voice, you know, it should be. He sings more Sinatra-like, and Bob Dylan, all that kind of stuff. And it's very nice. The music is very nice, but it's not nice when they sing it, or the band is playing it, because it's so loud that that's the story. The band today and the music, especially rap, it's terrible. So rhythmically good, but God, you can play loud drums. Well, even the drummers, the problem is amplification. You know, they amplify it so much.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I even went to a concert about 2-3 years ago where I wanted to hear a violinist, and it was terrible. This is at Oakdale, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's a big place now. But, again, it was so low, it didn't even sound like a violin.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, things have changed for sure.
Yeah, so no. Today's music is some of it is good, and but the thing that's popular, all these big concerts and all, they're too loud.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, Al. So
there's
probably not too many of you left from the World War II era, is there?
Not too many. That's not. I go and when I go to the veterans meetings, it's rare. I might come across one, I think. One, you know. And I'm surprised, you know, I don't know why I should be, but that's the story, yeah.
Well, it's been so interesting to hear, you know, we hear about people who serve in the military, and you did a great service to our country. And what you did was fantastic, helping refresh the troops, entertain the troops, and give them a break from the stress and difficulty of war.
Yeah.
So your contribution I see as very significant. And on this day, it's great to hear and be inspired by someone like yourself who's 100 years old and you, after a stroke, are taking up the trumpet again. So you're inspiring me, Al.
Yeah, and I'm still singing with the Waterbury Chorale. It's a, you know, we have about 90 voices in the chorale, and I'm still with them.
That's fantastic. And you have a quick laugh, which tells me that you still have a great attitude and a great joyful spirit, and that's contagious. So thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much. And I think of when I was in the Philippines and not in the band, yeah, on the boat, we had a couple of musicians got together and put shows on, you know, just out of the clear blue sky. And I remember how the guys on the ship, how they loved it, you know? I never forgot that.
Yeah.
And I wrote some words to a song, Basin Street Blues. They went wild over. I was, you know, it was really, really a good feeling.
Yeah, yeah, very satisfying. It's nice to have a job you love. And the way you served your country was admirable. Al, thank you so much for being on the show. I so appreciate having a conversation with you. God bless you, Al. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right. Have a good.
God bless you.
Thank you so much. 100 years old, a World War II veteran. Just a delight. Be back in a minute.
I can see, no matter how near you be, you never belong to me. But I can dream, can I? Can I pretend that I'm locked in the bend of your embrace?
What a delight to talk to a 100-year-old veteran. How cool is that? And, of course, I always love a little bit of Andrew Sisters music. You know, they got their start at a talent show in Minneapolis at the Orpheum Theater. Patty was only 12 at the time. They sang on the... Their audition piece was On the Sunny Side of the Street with Laverne on piano, and they won first place. And I got to tell you, the competition was pretty good that day. Second place winner was a little unknown ventriloquist named Edgar Bergen. So... odd facts known by few, but I'm one that can help you with that today. Thanks for listening. Got a great second hour coming up next, and I hope you're having a great, great Memorial Day. Be back in a minute.